From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When you think of Aristotle, if you do, it's probably Aristotle, the great ancient philosopher. My guest today wants to look at Aristotle, the biologist, the scientist, maybe the first scientist, sitting by a lagoon, observing oysters, dissecting cuttlefish. Wants to put him in the pantheon of Darwin and Pasteur. Aristotle, he says, invented science. Not exactly the scientific method, but how scientists think. This hour, On Point, back to the lagoon, Aristotle and the invention of science. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you think? Aristotle, inventor of science? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Armand Lois, professor of evolutionary developmental biology at Imperial College, London. His new book is The Lagoon, How Aristotle Invented Science. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Armand Lois, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So we think of Aristotle and we think logic and ethics and aesthetics and, you know, poetry, music, theater, rhetoric. You're going metaphysics, but you go to biology and zoology. When did this place this in his life? When did this come onto Aristotle's screen in such a big way? At what point in the arc of his life?
We think that Aristotle became a scientist, as it were, or began, well, let's not use the loaded word scientist quite yet.
Okay.
Began to turn away from the metaphysical concerns and the purely philosophical concerns that he learnt at Plato's Academy, where he lived and worked for 20 years. He was 17 when he arrived at Plato's Academy and, I guess, rose to become a lecturer then, in effect. And then in his mid-30s, Plato dies and Aristotle leaves. And he goes east. He goes across the Aegean to a place called Assos, which is now in modern-day Turkey, spends a couple of years there, gets married, and then he moves to Lesbos, which is an island that you can see from Assos. It's a Greek island in the eastern Aegean, and there he lives on the shores of a lagoon, and that, we think, is where he began to investigate the natural world.
We're going to get deeply into that lagoon. You spent a lot of time there. We want you to place us there as well. But describe the change of outlook that this move represented from Platonism, how Plato looked at the world, to how Aristotle would come to see the world.
It's a profound change. And I think that there's almost no greater division in some ways in the history of thought than between Plato and Aristotle. I want to nuance that, but at its core, it is a question about reality and what we should be studying. Plato, as you know, believed that the world that we see is a world that is but a copy, an imperfect copy, a shadow, as it were, of some more perfect realm that exists beyond the senses. And Plato says that more perfect realm beyond the senses, the realm of ideas, of pure form, that is the thing that we should be discovering, that we should be studying. And he devoted a lot of time to thinking about mathematical forms and how this invisible world was structured. Aristotle says, no. This concept of the forms beyond the senses, it annihilates the study of nature. What we should be doing is studying the things directly in front of us. There are no mystical forms out there. There is only the world that we can perceive directly with our senses. And that is what we should be doing. So when I say that the great division, that this is one of the great divisions in human thought, it is the division that still exists today between idealist and realist philosophies, and it's a division which runs right through the history of human thought, and I think that that's the most fundamental part of it.
Armand, not all people by any means, but many people today are so deeply in the empirical world, the empirical way of seeing things, that they may not even get the Platonist view of things. It takes us back almost to a sense of the gods. What, this may be an impossible question, but why do you think Plato went first there instead of to the world right around him, the material world beneath his feet?
I'm not sure I can answer that question very convincingly. I believe it has something to do with Plato's desire for a source of stability. Heraclitus tells us everything is in motion. Plato didn't like that. Plato wanted something firm to grip on, something that would stay constant beneath all the flux of events and I think also the political instability of his time. Plato is in some ways a natural conservative. And in doing so, he postulated that there must be this eternal, constant, perfect entities world that will provide us with assurance that things will ultimately remain the same.
When Plato died and Aristotle went across the Aegean to this island near Turkey, Lesbos, sat down by his lagoon, did he come with his change of worldview from Plato already intact, or did he develop it sitting and observing closely the life of the lagoon?
It's very difficult to work that out. We don't have any good chronology of Aristotle's life or any good intellectual chronology. We don't have any works that by him. We don't have a diary that says, I was here, I did that, I thought this. What we have are these texts, and 2,000 years of scholarship have attempted to crack the order in which they've been written, have attempted to show that that his thought developed in one way rather than another way, and so on. And suffice to say, it's all terribly unconvincing. At best, I think what we can say is that he began his life, his intellectual life, as a Platonist, writing dialogues, much like Plato did, mm-hmm. on the kinds of subjects that he did. And then somewhere in his mid-30s, he does begin to make a change. It's clear that he's doing empirical work there in the Eastern Aegean. And that he continues to do this throughout much of his life. But I think it would be too much to say that there's a radical transformation from the philosophers into the scientists. And bear in mind, those are modern terms anyway. Mm-hmm. Rather, should we say that the scientist, or what we would now call the scientist, is added to the philosopher, such that by the time you come to the end of his life and we see the works that we have, it looks as though you have one amazing, vast intellectual system. And it is an enormous system, possibly the greatest intellectual system ever built by one man, which goes from metaphysical bedrock all the way to the deepest biological questions and then through up to his conception of God.
I am so eager to get to all that and to sit by that lagoon with you a bit, but give us some of your detective work, if you would, that gave you the confidence to say, here's the island, here's the lagoon. You've gone back year after year to sit where Aristotle, you're saying, sat. What gives you the confidence that that's the lagoon?
Well, if you go through his texts, his biology texts, there's one place that he mentions a lot, and it is this place called Pyrrha, this lagoon. And he says all sorts of things about it. He says that the fish migrate in at certain times of years and then they migrate out. He says there are lots of cuttlefish, but he says, on the other hand, there are no sharks. He says he speaks of the scallops that have been waxing and waning, he says, in the entrance of the lagoon. There used to be a lot of them, but now the fishermen come along and they say that there aren't any of them left because they've all been fished out. Well, these sorts of things just remain eternal. I mean, when I went to the lagoon, I talked to the fishermen about them and they said, well, there used to be lots of scallops over there in the entrance of the lagoon, but they've all been fished out. And, he's not talking about Aristotle's time. It's clear that is that the scallops have been waxing and waning there for, 2,000 years and more. And if you go there, with his book, you just get that overwhelming sense that this is where he was working, because the creatures that he talks about are so very apparent there. One of them is the cuttlefish, of which I can tell you an inordinate amount, because they crop up there in the spring. They come in by the thousands. They lay their eggs, just as Aristotle describes, on branches which the fishermen put out, just as Aristotle describes, and they hatch. And they copulate, and then they die, and you can take them out and you can cut them open and dissect them, just in the way that Aristotle describes.
Did he think he was doing something strange or odd to others when he made all these observations about the natural life of this lagoon?
Yes, absolutely. He's a very self-conscious intellectual, a very self-conscious pioneer, and he knows that he has to defend himself against his colleagues, against Plato, who, to the degree that Plato is interested in the natural world at all, he's only interested in the stars because they have that sort of perfect geometry that he loves. He knows that everybody else thinks that the creatures that fascinate him are rather disgusting. They're not worthy of study. Their study is related to medicine, but I mean, it doesn't even have the dignity of that. And so he actually then has a passage in which he speaks about this.
Hold the passage, Armand. We'll come right back and get it. It's a terrific passage, often called the Invitation to Biology. Hold those words of Aristotle, if you would. Armand Loa, the new book is The Lagoon, How Aristotle Invented Science. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle and the origins of science, maybe the scientific way of looking at the world. The assertion of Armand Loa's new book is clear in the title, The Lagoon, How Aristotle Invented Science. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He's professor of evolutionary developmental biology at Imperial College in London, joins us from London today. Armand, I wish you'd read for us, you were, I think, about to there, this wonderful passage often called The Invitation to Biology, saying that it doesn't all have to be a high philosophy, just come sit by the stove, the simple things. Could you read, set it up and read for us?
I can indeed, Tom. So it's all about defending science, this new thing that he's doing against Plato and his school. And I think what you have to do is to imagine, perhaps you have to imagine him teaching some students. He had a school, Aristotle did, the Lyceum, and he's got a mound of cuttlefish or something else, kind of disgusting, which is just sort of decomposing there in the sun, the Greek sun, and he wants the students to cut them up, and they look at him and they say, yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And he gets irritated, as any professor would, and he says, so we should not, like children, react with disgust to the investigation of the less elevated animals. There is something awesome in all natural things. Some strangers, so the story goes, wanted to meet Heraclitus. They approached him, but saw that he was warming himself by the stove. Don't worry, he said. Come on in. There are gods here, too. One should, similarly, approach research on animals of whatever type without hesitation. For inherent in each of them, there is something natural and beautiful. Nothing is accidental in the works of nature. Everything is absolutely for the sake of something else. The purpose for which each has come together or come into being deserves its place among what is beautiful.
The passage.
And that is the passage.
Yeah, called The Invitation to Biology. There are gods here too, and these cuttlefish and humble forms of life. It's just wonderful.
And you can imagine what I felt like as a biologist when I read that for the first time. Here it was, the argument for my science, for the thing that I've devoted my own life to and made 23 centuries ago. I mean, you just have to love him. I just had to say, yes, that I have to write about this. I have to study it.
I have to say, all the social media pouring into us right now, as we speak, are groaning with lots of attitudes and no small amount of skepticism about this way of looking at Aristotle. We'll come to that, but I wish you just paint a picture of the lagoon for us first. You've gone back year after year. Put us at its side as Aristotle may have seen it 23 centuries ago. That's a long time.
It is a long time. I don't think that it's actually changed very much. If you go there, you can see all the animals that Aristotle describes, and in much the same way that he did. There are some new things. There are flamingos there now. And Aristotle doesn't describe them. In fact, he says nothing about flamingos whatsoever and all the birds that he describes. And yet, if you go there, they're the most obvious sort of animals. And the answer to that is the answer to that little mystery is very straightforward. It turns out that they started coming about 50, 60 years ago when the marshes of the Camarage in Spain started drying up. So they sort of migrated out to Lesbos. And that gives us a sign that things aren't exactly as they were. The lagoon is also deeper. The ruins that were previously above water, they're now completely sunk. And that's just because of the 2,300 years. There's been actually enough tectonic movement in the Eastern Aegean just to lower the earth a little bit.
Get us into the daily routine of Aristotle, or at least the heart of his exploration of what he saw. What he was dissecting, we heard some of that. He was trying to build. He was looking at reproduction. He was looking at anatomy. He was trying to. I don't know if this was conscious or not, but in effect, build a taxonomy, sort of categorize and order what he saw.
He's doing many things simultaneously in terms of his ultimate intellectual objectives. In terms of the way he's doing it, well, the first thing he's doing is he's hoovering up all the information that he can. He's found a new world, and he wants to know everything about it. So he does his own observations, gets animals, cuts them up, you know, gets them from the fishmonger, presumably. He clearly spends a lot of time talking to people, spends a lot of time talking to fishermen and hunters and beekeepers and farmers, because information from all these people is just riddled through his, it just runs right throughout his texts. And then he also hoovers up all the literature he can. He goes through the stories of travelers like Herodotus, for example. And Herodotus says all sorts of things about the animals, you know, in the different parts of the world that he knows. Some of it is accurate. Some of it is complete nonsense. Aristotle sort of sorts through all this stuff and tries to, you know, keeps what seems reasonable, quotes, but then kind of says, Herodotus says, in a, you know, somewhat disparaging way, you know, that about uncertain facts, and then just discards some things as absolutely improbable. And some things he just flatly contradicts him. He says, you know, Herodotus says that Ethiopians have ejaculate black sperm. Well, that's just nonsense. I mean, you know, it just makes no sense to Aristotle whatsoever, and he knows it too. So he's sorting throughout all this information and getting and hoovering up all the data that he can, and then he begins to order it. And one way in which he begins to order it is indeed by classifying the creatures that he finds into big groups. This is actually an interesting classification or definition, is something that he gets from Plato's Academy. But actually, although he does lay the foundations of what will become our modern classification system, there's no doubt about it, and some of his classifications are really very good, he's no proto-Linnaeus, the modern father of classification, the 18th century Swedish biologist. Rather, what he's really interested in is understanding the relationships between the parts of creatures. He wants to know how they all fit together. For instance, why some birds have very small beaks, hard beaks, but then short legs, while other birds have really long beaks and then really long legs. And other birds have bills and then have webbed feet, and so on. He's interested in those kinds of relationships between parts, because what he really wants to understand is how creatures work and how they are fitted to their environments.
Armand Loire is an evolutionary biologist. He joins us from London. His new book is The Lagoon, How Aristotle Invented Science. It's a big claim. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Armand, callers for you, many. Louisiana, Thibodeau, Louisiana. Gary, you're on the air with Armand Loire in London.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I teach developmental biology And my favorite Aristotle story to go to is where he describes the difference between viviparous animals and oviparous animals. Because I'm interested in how eggs are made, I think it's beautiful that he mentions that the yolk of an egg is like the milk of the breast of a mammal. It's a perfect example of like early comparative physiology, looking at how two different animals get the same thing done, but they get to it in a different way.
But what is the comparison? The yolk is the creature itself. The milk of the breast is the sustenance. Or do I misunderstand, Gary?
Well, in order to make an egg, like in a fish egg or a chicken egg, the mother sends energy, protein energy, into an egg. And that egg, the yolk, it's not really going to be the baby chick. The chick actually grows around the yolk and takes that nourishment.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a perfect investment from mother to young. And then with the breast milk, it's very similar.
Yes.
It's an investment of mother maternal energy into the young, done in two different types of animals in a different way, yet there's a similarity there.
All these centuries later, you have admiration as an evolutionary biologist yourself for this work 23 centuries back, Gary.
Yeah, it leads to more molecular ideas, like what is the difference in the protein of the yolk and the protein of the milk? In milk, there's casein. That kind of does the same job as the yolk protein, which is vitellogenin. Both of these proteins bring in nourishment to the young, but they both do it in different ways. So, you know, at a comparative physiology level, I love what he said so many years ago.
What do you think of the claim, Aristotle as first scientist or inventing science?
That I'm totally good with that. And the other thing that I think about is marine biology. I guess you could just as well say he invented marine biology. And to me, it's the marine biology that doesn't come with really being interested in the squid exactly, but leaving land and going to the sea and then being able to have like new thoughts about animals. Like this is what happened at Woods Hole. People that were interested in cell biology, they went to Woods Hole and they were maybe freer to figure it out with different marine organisms than they were able to do that right in their own lab at Harvard or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do in Louisiana at a little marine lab called LumCon.
Mm-hmm. Being at the water's edge, being right there.
Scientists get to the water's edge. These are ideas that they're already thinking about on land, but there's something about sea creatures, and then maybe there's something about just being at the sea that allows a little bit more camaraderie or free thought or something like that, and it seems to work.
Gary, wonderful to have your call from Thibodeau. Armand Loi in London, thoughts on our on your fellow evolutionary biologist, developmental biologist observations there?
Well, it is so nice to hear from another Aristotle fan. And you know something, I could comment on all sorts of things, but I'll just say what he says about getting down to the shore is so true. And actually, part of this voyage into Aristotle has been, for me, a getting back to the shore. Because when I was an undergraduate, I spent a lot of time at marine labs up in Friday Harbor in Washington and Bamfield in British Columbia, and I left it behind. And it was only when I came back to Aristotle that I came back to the shore and discovered the joys of actually looking at things back in their habitat opposed to in the lab.
What about the legion critics here who say, are you kidding me? It wasn't him, it was all of humanity. It wasn't him, it was the Egyptians. Yes, he made observations, but he actually derailed science for years. That's why Sir Francis Bacon tore into him centuries later.
Yeah. So let's be clear why Francis Bacon tore into him. Mm. Francis Bacon tore into him and the Aristotelians, because he had to. For centuries, for millennia, what we knew about the natural world really came from Aristotle. And with the revival of learning in the Renaissance, people read him. And Christian theologians, like Aquinas, elevated him to the master of men, the master of those who know. The phrase is actually Dante's. Mm-hmm. He became intellectually dominant, and it was the discovery, it was the reasoning of the first early modern scientists men like Bacon and Hooke, the men of the Royal Society, and the Italians, men like Redi, who saw that we could not advance if we were just to read Aristotle. We actually had to get out there and study nature rather than books. Aristotle had to be destroyed if we were going to pass through the gates of philosophy and reach the green fields of science that lay beyond.
Let me give you a couple of complaints on that front here. I want to come back to Bacon, but just on origins of science, Emil says, are you serious? Science was started in Egypt with Imhotep. Imhotep, forget Aristotle was taught in Africa, Emil writes. Dom writes, Aristotle codified natural philosophy, writing here from Miami, says, delayed science until 1800, Dalton in atomic theory. Armand.
Right. Don't know much about the Egyptians there. Aristotle certainly didn't learn anything from them, didn't go to Africa, that much we know. There may be scattered observations about the natural world. There's some astronomy in Egypt, certainly. But what Aristotle gives us for the first time, and I think this is the critical thing, is that he gives us that core scientific idea that what we must do to understand the natural world is speculate, have theories, but that those theories must be tempered by empirical observation. Before Aristotle, there are lots of people, lots of philosophers, pre-Socratic philosophers, who are spending a lot of time speculating about the nature of the world, where it comes from, where it's going, what it's made of, and all those sorts of things. These are the pre-Socratic philosophers like Democritus and Empedocles. Mm-hmm. As far as we can tell, they never actually so much as got out of their armchairs once to actually test any of their ideas. What Aristotle does is he actually takes these ideas, adds to them himself, and then actually tests them. He goes down to the shore, he cuts up animals, and he investigates whether they're actually true. He considers them in a systematic fashion. It is that which is the essence of science, and it is that why he begins it. As towards Aristotle's malign effects, yes, but you can hardly blame him for the way people used his work 2,000 years later. And that brings me back to what I was saying about Bacon. Bacon disliked him because his authority was so great. And Bacon was correct. His authority had to be destroyed in order that we would go back out and study nature again. But the cost of that is that we've forgotten him. He's become a byword for ignorance, like your listener said. Mm-hmm. And so we've forgotten just how great his accomplishments are. We've forgotten all the things that he taught us, and actually that we know because he told us, because his science still runs through the structure of our own science, very much so.
It's ironic that his greatest students for centuries would move away from the lagoon, take it, put it back in the, leave it in the books, require Bacon and the rest to come and charge back out into the world.
It is. It's a strange irony, a sad one.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle and the origins of science, the scientific way of looking at the world. Armand Loi is with us, professor of evolutionary developmental biology at the Imperial College London and author of the big new book, The Lagoon, How Aristotle Invented Science. Left Athens, went off to the eastern Aegean, Isle of Lesbos near Turkey, and sat down there, Armand tells us, by a lagoon, thinking, getting his hands dirty, dissecting, watching, classifying, bringing us a scientific way of looking at the world. You can join us this hour. Are we still doing what Aristotle did, collecting data, building taxonomies, ordering the world, looking for patterns? Has all this science brought us wisdom, brought us closer, as Aristotle imagined, to God? Ultimately, we'll look. So many callers and comments for you, Armand. Please stand by in London. Martin in Austin, Texas. Martin, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for having me on the air, Tom.
Yes.
On your show, On Point. Armand has it wrong. It was Archimedes who should be nominated as the father of science.
Make the case, Martin.
Oh, Archimedes was both an experimentalist and tested out his, and a theorist. He tested out his theories. Aristotle was not. Aristotle was like a classificationist, a stamp collector, if you would have it. He classified. First real science was done by Archimedes. And if you think about it, it's concentric spheres of knowledge. Since then, Archimedes, Galileo, Newton, Maxwell, Einstein, they build on each other. And the theories aren't overthrown. They're just, or their work is not overthrown. It's encompassed and builds on it.
Martin, I love it. Let us pick it up. Let us pick it up with Armand, if you'd be good enough. Archimedes, displacement of water. Martin wants to give him credit, Armand. What do you say?
Archimedes, great man. But Martin has given us a physicist's history of science. He's given us a history that just leaves biology out. I think that's part of the problem here. It's usually the physicists who have written the history of science. To say that Aristotle was merely a stamp collector is a classic physicist insult to a biologist.
This is because he's classifying, building taxonomies, ordering.
That's right, because his subject is about diversity, the diversity of things in the world. It's about all those different creatures, and physicists aren't really doing that. What they have is a few regularities which they try to abstract and make descriptive laws about, and causal laws too. But to say Aristotle is a stamp collector is as unjust as if to say Darwin is a stamp collector, because they both have fundamentally the same project at hand. And what they are both doing is actually trying to explain the world, because Aristotle didn't just write the one book, Historia Animalium, in which he pulls together all the information that he has. Rather, he just uses that as a starting point for writing half a dozen other books. And those other books are books of explanation.
Yeah, but maybe, but wait a minute. I mean, Darwin drew the great insight, perhaps, out of his observation. What did Aristotle draw in terms of insight?
Darwin drew one of the greatest insights of all time about the structure of the natural world, but Aristotle paved the way for him. How Aristotle paves the way is that he explains, he's the first person to explain the fit of the forms of creatures in terms of their environment. He says, he gives us and tells us that creatures are built in such a way as to survive and reproduce in their environments. This sounds very evolutionary. Mm. It's not, actually. It's a stepping stone towards evolution, but it isn't an evolutionary theory. He also tells us about how creatures inherit their forms from their parents. He takes Plato's theory of forms, and he tells us that really the way in which they build their bodies is contingent upon the information that they get from their parents, which is transmitted via the seminal fluids. He tells us how they develop in the womb, which my friend Gary Louisiana alluded to. He's a great developmental biologist, and he gives a theoretical account of this, a very good one. He gives us a theory of genetics, a theory of inheritance. Its details are wrong, but it's the best theory out there until Mendel published his.
You've got this great phrase that illuminates a lot of this: the dolphins snore. Speak to us on this front.
About the dolphins snore?
Yes, please.
Aristotle is trying to work out what dolphins are. They've got some of the features of quadrupeds, and they breathe air, they suckle their young, they're warm blooded, they snore, just like any quadruped does, any four footed animal, any what we would now call a mammal does, and yet they look like fish, and they swim in the sea, they eat fish. They have all the habits of fish. And so Aristotle puzzles over what to do about dolphins. He comes up with a solution. He doesn't call them mammals. because the concept of mammals hasn't been invented yet. He recognizes that they're not fish. So he comes up with a third solution, and he calls them cetacea, which mean literally monsters, monstrous type animals. And indeed, that's the origin of the modern technical name for whales and dolphins. And he says they're a class in themselves, which dualize, which have these different features. And it's a brilliant bit of zoology. And what's really amazing about it is that his successors, they just ignored him and they just called them fish.
Brilliant, but imperfect. I mean, you remind us, you're skeptical that he ever dissected a dolphin. He gets the dolphin's mouth in the wrong place. Was he just talking with fishermen? Or what do you make of that?
Yes, well, that is a little bit surprising, I have to say. So he says that dolphins have underslung jaws.
Like a shark.
You know, like sharks do. And you really have to sort of wonder what's going on here. Did he never actually dissect a dolphin? I mean, some of the rest of his anatomy is pretty good. I think, well, there's all sorts of possibilities. Whenever you find Aristotle who makes a mistake, you're always tempted to say that somebody else has been messing around with the text. And lots of people have clearly been messing around with the text. But I have to say, in this case, it looks like he said it because he said it twice. I think it's something that he's getting from popular iconography. If you look at pictures of dolphins on coins of the time, they're often depicted with sort of underslung mandibles. You know, and it's not the only mistake he makes by any means, empirical mistake. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, oddities that he says, but, you know, which run throughout his books. But you have to put them in context. His big book of descriptive biology, Historia Animalium, has, I estimate, but I haven't counted them all, something like 9,000 distinct empirical claims. I mean, it's just a list of, you know, this is so and so about how things, you know, eat, feed, reproduce, you know, mate, breed, you know, travel, migrate, sleep, snore, whatever. And there's bound to be a certain number of things which he just gets wrong, you know, which he gets from other people and he makes mistakes about. But that's inevitable when you're discovering a new world and just trying to figure out what it's all about.
Let's go to Raymond in New York, Plattsburgh, New York. Raymond, thanks for calling. You're on with Armand Leroy in London.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Dr. Leroy. What strikes me as most curious is that Alexander the Great and his companions, like Ptolemy, were students of the Lycea that Aristotle founded. And they seem to have followed through on his studies. When Alexander went on his conquest, he took along students to classify new things and discover new methods of irrigation, etc., much like Napoleon did when he went to Egypt, and I just thought that was an interesting thing.
Raymond, our line is rough, but I appreciate your call. Armand, yes, of course, Aristotle taught Alexander the Great. Evidence of that in Alexander's interactions with the world?
Well, this is a fascinating question. I mean, it is really a remarkable story. You know, here we have one of history's greatest thinkers who has, for just a few years, the whip hand over what will become one of history's greatest generals. And you just have to wonder, you know, did Aristotle make Alexander into the man that he would become, or did he just try to temper? Did he try to keep the future megalomaniac conqueror of the world under control? We'd love to know, but we don't. There's a story, and it's a story that Pliny tells, that Alexander, traveling east, conquering the world, commanded all his generals to send all the animals that they found back to Aristotle in Academy, at the Lyceum, so that he could cut them up. A sort of homage to his old teacher. It's a lovely story. I don't think it's true, as your listener said. There's no doubt about it that Alexander took some Lyceum trained intellectuals with him on his campaign, one of whom was Callisthenes, who was in fact Aristotle's nephew. And we know quite a lot about this. Callisthenes was a historian, went along there to record and a natural philosopher, went along to record the progress of the army in the East and send reports back to Athens, and at some point got on the bad side of Alexander, who had him executed.
Yeah.
In a number of horrible ways, which I won't go into because we don't actually know what they were, and they were described, but they were all pretty disgusting. And so that seems to have sort of soured relations between Aristotle and Alexander a bit. We think that Callisthenes or somebody else like him, another one of those intellectuals, sent information back to Aristotle about the exotic animals of the East. I don't think that any animals actually were sent. There's a story that, for instance, about an elephant which traveled all the way, you know, from India, sent back by Alexander, all the way to Athens. I just don't think it happened. Aristotle's just not good enough on elephants, you know, to really convince us that he actually saw one, although he's got a lot to say about them.
We've got such deep, rigorous questions, challenges for you online. I want to go to them. Here are a couple. One from a Vermont veteran says, philosophy is science. Addressing you here, Aman. At least this is the case for from the modern perspective. And then another, very interesting. Chris says, I grant you, Aristotle was one of the first rigorous empiricists. But Plato was perhaps not as anti-scientific as you claim, he's saying, Armand. Plato looked behind appearances for the same reasons that scientists look for patterns in the world. It's just that he was a little bit too greedy and thought he could go to the fundamentals from thought alone without getting his hands dirty through observation. In a sense, he was really the first rigorous proponent of a, quote, theory of everything, which is something we still come across today in the world of physics. In fact, Max Tegmark at MIT calls himself a Platonist on steroids. Of course, Max Tegmark, the famous Swedish-American cosmologist at MIT, calling himself a Platonist and certainly a scientist, Armand.
Well, Max would, wouldn't he?
Well.
I mean, he's a guy who spends his time, you know, imagining how many universes there are and thinking about things in the most abstract way. Your listener is absolutely right. There is this divide between... there is this tension that runs through science between the grand theories, the mathematical theories, which physicists love, especially the Tegmarks of the world, and the grubby details that biologists so love, which also get expressed in terms of theory, but somehow it's got a much more tangible feel to it. Biologists tend, as a whole, to be much more suspicious of grand theory. It's because we've got all that diversity to deal with. Yes, Plato does perhaps deserve some credit. I mean,
certainly to a cosmologist,
to a cosmologist for initiating that. That belief that the natural world can be apprehended through mathematics, that it has a deep beauty and order. I mean, was it not Plato who wrote, let no one ignorant of geometry enter here on the lintel above the entrance to his academy? And it's still as it's there above the entrance to every physics department, even if you can't see it.
Armand, let me get one more call. Christopher in Austin, Texas. Christopher, our time is short, but please make your case.
I just wanted to make a comment. Well, I mean, I work in artificial intelligence and I have a degree in philosophy, but, you know, actually working outside of academia. And I agree completely 100% that Aristotle was the first scientist. Like, that is, you know, I've had to read all of Aristotle's works in school, and that's how I've always thought of Aristotle. Plato's place as sort of the first, or Plato's / Socrates, their place as the first philosopher. To me, the question here is not really a divide between science, but a divide between actually realities, the subject and the object. Empiricism, science, deals with things that are objective. That's one reality that every human experiences. But the the questions of language, logic, mathematics, rhetoric, the Platonic heaven, those things that humans deal with grand theories as well. And I think that that's the credit that should be due to Plato, though I completely 100% agree that Aristotle was the first scientist, I think he needs total credit for that.
Christopher, thanks so much for that. Our time is short right here. Armand Loire, you say Aristotle's view in some ways, since Francis Bacon, Enlightenment, is coming back in the era of big data. Just got 30 seconds here, Armand.
I think that's right. Aristotle, what makes him special is that he began his science by discovering a new world, the world of living things. We too are now once again in Aristotle's position because our new machines, the gene sequencers, the proteomics machines, the metabolomics machines, all those things are giving us all the data we can possibly consume and we don't know what to do with it. And so all we can do is hoover it up and look for patterns and that kind of science. It doesn't look like the experimental science that the Royal Society told us to do, that the man of the Royal Society, Bacon, told us to do. It looks much more like Aristotle science. And that's why I think he's the man for our age.
Sympathy again with Aristotle there, inventor of sciences, Armand Loire, in his new book, The Lagoon. Armand, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Thank you.